I'm Bill Lennon, and I have been talking about sexual misconduct issues in the churches this week. This is the third presentation that I've done this week. And I'm working at, and I think succeeding in, having each one of the presentations stand alone so that you get something, because if you're out on a hike and you come in and you get this piece and you don't get the other pieces. And yet it is in something of a progression. The first day I talked about some patterns of an individual who is in a sexually abusive / power abusive situation. I stressed and will continue to stress that one of the issues that I'd like to really shift our emphasis on is that we are talking about pastors and parishioners, and that's not all we're talking about. We're talking about anybody in a greater position of power, which could be a Sunday school teacher and a child, could be a pastor and a parishioner, could be a whatever. And the crucial point that I was stressing in the first day was that it's as horrible as the quote-unquote sexual act is or may be. That's not really the issue. It's more the issue of the process. The thing that, and we'll talk more about that tomorrow, the thing that becomes most devastating to the victim is the process of being used by someone who, I am vulnerable and that person is in a greater power position than I'm in, and that's the crucial issue, and I worked on some different examples about that. The action step that I strongly recommended out of the first day is break secrets. Don't be a part of a secret that what happens, and Marie Fortune in her book talks a lot about in one of her chapters, I think in a really good way, how the church becomes a family model, and in the sense that it's a family model, then it's a real setup for incest. And so it can well be, as a setup for incest, it can well be you have the offender, you have the non-offending partner, and you have the victim, which is like an incestual kind of thing. And where the secrecy comes in is for the offender, who is caught in this incredible secrecy and probably has been caught in that secrecy for 20 years, 30 years, whatever, and his or her only chance of any kind of healing and restoration comes out of getting out of the secrecy stuff. The non-offending partner, which in a family becomes maybe the spouse, in a church becomes the church body, the corporate body that agrees to keep quiet about this. Let's just let the guy quit. Let's get him out of here. Let's don't say anything. This is too uncomfortable. This is too ugly. Whatever, and so becomes a compliant, codependent, non-offending partner, and seemingly on the short term, that may seem to work, but the dysfunction and the pain stays, and numerous things happen, all of which are bad. One of the minor things that happens, none of this is minor, is that the next pastor comes in and can't figure why things are so sick. Because he doesn't know anything about this, because that's all kept secret. At any rate, so I talked the first day about whatever, don't be a part of hearing wonderful reasons why we should keep this quiet at many different levels. It's not something to be kept quiet. The second day talked more about the whole idea of some of the patterns that someone who is in the offending role uses, and I use the term grooming to set someone up, how we get closer to someone, the way we desensitize someone to, and it's all the way we make friends, you know, we talk a little bit, and we touch on the shoulder, and we get closer and closer and closer, And it's the motivation that's behind it is a crucial thing. It's not so much what you do, but it's what's your goal. Because I showed two different overheads in which I believe this, and I get this feedback quite a bit. Page one of the two overheads is the way we make friends with people. You know, people do that. You know, I don't take someone who's a total stranger and run up to you and throw my arms around you and hug you, but maybe after a week of we talk and we go get coffee and some of that. So we desensitize and we get closer too. And what's the motivation? Is the motivation to develop empathy and to be closer, and I share myself and you share yourself and we become closer? Or is the motivation to consciously or unconsciously set you up so that I, in my, and I'm hitting this kind of quick, but in my narcissistic need to have some of my deficits fixed, use you sexually to make me feel okay? You know, from whence do I come? What's my motivation? Talked about that. My action step that I recommended strongly from Tuesday is pay attention to your gut. Every time I work in schools and in churches, when something like this explodes, and it's no longer a case of did it really happen or not, or you know, but we really know and everybody has admitted it, and you're doing an investigation, there are half a dozen people that say, I knew that whole thing was weird. It was just something about the way he'd hug kids or whatever. There are people that knew something, but they don't do anything with it, you know. Then you go through all the reasons why you don't do anything. Well, I can't risk ruining a guy's career. I'm probably reading it wrong. You know, and you find all your reasons not to say anything to anybody. So my strong recommendation from the second day was talk to somebody. Don't try to take your own frame of reference, which is a limited one. If things are going off inside of you and you just don't feel right about something, either with yourself or with something else that you observe. Okay, so that was the thing that we did the second day. Today, we're going to talk... let me start with this overhead. I'd ask you questions. I mean, I'd ask you to ask questions right now, but I'm not going to do that because questions would probably be catch-up. And there are tapes of that, and I'll also talk with any of you about that if you want to do some catch-up on the other things that we did. But I want to talk a little bit about... These are some statistics that came out of an employee assistance publication about a year and a half ago. So they're a little dated, but they've got across the concept that I want to get across. And that is a thing that I want to make a main theme today, is some comparisons between different quote-unquote addictions. Let me define addiction a little bit the way I'm defining it first. There are several components of an addiction, and what I'll do is I'll keep staying very generic about it, about any kind of an addiction, because I want you to get the idea of workaholism as an addiction, about sex as an addiction, about alcohol as an addiction. That's one of the themes that I'm pressing today. When I say workaholism or alcoholism, I'm not talking about just the amount of it that you do. That's not the issue. There are people who work an enormous amount who are not addicted to work. There are people who drink an enormous amount who are not addicted to alcohol. Does that make sense? You follow me? Now, there are people who drink an enormous amount who are addicted to alcohol. But because you drink a lot, or because you work a lot, or because you do sex a lot, does not necessarily mean you're addicted to those things. It might mean that. That may be one of the indications. I'm going to give you a little test today to sort of the sexual addiction screening test and let you take a look at that. But we won't put any names on it. But I thought I'd throw that in because if, you know, a little tension, like, we're going to do that, you know? So anyway, it's kind of fun to keep the tension up just a little bit. Alcoholism and alcohol abuse 15% of our population, at least population based on 240 million Americans, about 36 million people. Now, to get in this statistic, somebody has defined you clearly as having that addiction. And that may be more specific than the definition that I just said I was going to give and didn't give. And suddenly my mind went click and I thought, I didn't give that, did I? Let me give you some of the criteria that I work with for addiction. One of the criteria is that it's a repetitive act. You go back and you do it again and again. You don't necessarily do it every day. You repetitively do it though. Maybe you do it once a month, maybe you do it once every 6 months, whatever. But you do go back and repeat the same act. When I repeat breathing too, I don't know whether I'm addicted to breathing, but another component of that is that there is, in that repetitive act, there's some cost to it, financially, emotionally, or both. But it costs you something in a negative kind of sense. You got to put out some money, you've got to put out some emotional energy around it. Did I say enough about that? I'm getting a few heads going this way. So another component of it is for what I'm talking about here, as I'm defining addiction, is that somewhere, and this is easier to spot in some areas than another, but if you tease it out and work with it, I invariably find it, if it has to do with addiction, there's some kind of shame base to it. There's something about it that you don't feel good about. It may be extreme, it may be subtle, but it's always there if we talk about it. You don't really like it. A fourth component is that you have tried on numerous occasions to stop the behavior, and it just didn't work. Now, then you kick in with all your, you know, we're really good at figuring out how to not admit that we tried to stop the behavior, but somewhere in there, you've put some energy into not doing this behavior, whatever it is, and it didn't work. So then you begin rationalizing why it's okay to do it. Now, the alcohol example, the chemical dependency example that I run into a lot, and it's so simple, and any of you that have done any work in this area have probably asked the same question. I will ask somebody about alcohol, do you have an alcohol problem? And usually they'll say no, and I'll say, how about going 90 days without a drink? And it's, well, I don't need to do that because I don't have a problem. But will you go 90 days? Well, no, I won't go 90 days. You know, then begin, I'm not going to do that. I don't need to do that. Well, are you willing to give that up? So we play with that a little bit. Usually, if I'm working with somebody, that ends our interaction, because I will say, if I can't get a contract with you pretty early to give that a try, I don't know that we've got any basis upon which to do any work together. But if you're willing to give that a try, it's kind of fun. Why don't you go to the party? I'll coach people how to do that. Why don't you do whatever you do? You know, grab the ginger ale and put a little lemon or lime in there and walk around. See what it feels like. Is there any pull? Is it difficult for you to do or not? If it's difficult, then maybe there's a problem there. If it's not difficult, we'll talk again in 90 days, and you were right and I was wrong, and we're both happy. So anyway, we play with that kind of thing. The last element that I look at in an addiction is that there's tolerance. It takes some kind of buildup, so it takes more of whatever it is, of this, of any of these, it takes more of it to get you there than it did originally. So, does that make some sense?
Yeah.
When it gets into the sexual thing, it gets a little bit more, people think, come on, sex addiction. But one of the examples that I'll use is, can you ever remember a time when the National Geographic was exciting? I mean, you know, you couldn't hardly wait till that thing got in the mail because you're going to see some boobs, and you didn't want anybody to know that, but and maybe some of the Sears catalog lingerie ads and some of that stuff. What does that do for you now? Well, absolutely nothing. Well, what does it take now? Well, maybe it's a penthouse, maybe it's a hustler, maybe it's a live contact. Do you see what I mean? That's tolerance, to get you to the same place that it took you to get before, and true with all those. Yes? How does it work with food?
Just the way it pulls up?
I'm going to talk some about that in a minute. Let me hold that for now. Eating disorders, you can see 10.4%. Other drug addictions, 8.3%. Co-addicts, 8.3%. I think that's way, way, way low for whatever it's worth, but that one's harder to define. But workaholism, when we list workaholism here, I want to stress again, I don't mean people that work a whole bunch. You know, what I mean is people that use work to keep from dealing with pain, like you use alcohol to keep from dealing with pain. You know, I don't really want to talk it through with my family. I don't want to deal with that. I'll just work two more hours today. And anyway, everybody reinforces me for being a good hard worker. Anyway, keeps my anxiety down, and there's a whole lot of stuff. That's what I mean by that. And sex and love addiction, 6%. Gambling addiction, 1.6%. Well, that's kind of interesting, because according to that EAP survey, that gives 55.8% of us have some well-identified, need-to-be-in-treatment kinds of roaring addictions going on. And then whenever we work with addictions, the thing, the magic number is 3. You know, rarely do I have 1. You know, maybe I got one going with smoking, maybe I got one going with weight, and also one with alcohol, you know, that kind of thing. It's usually 2s and 3s. It's not usually 1 that we deal with those kinds of impaired Americans. Okay, anyway, having thrown that idea at you, I'd like to make a comparison, some comparisons about food and chemical dependency, sexual addiction, and eating disorders. The easiest thing to see is chemical dependency. You know, we ingest something from out there into here. And so the definitions that I gave for addiction are a lot easier to see. And they're also a lot easier to see what I have to do about them. I'm not saying it's easy to do. I'm saying it's easier to see what I have to do about them. If I have an eating disorder problem, or if I have a sexual addiction problem, I can't quit eating. And I can't do that. That doesn't work. I'm going to die. And I can't quit being a sexual being. That doesn't work. And for one thing, it's impossible to do. Another thing is, I think it's very unhealthy. To quit eating, I would die. And to quit being a sexual being, I would cut out so much of what I have to offer in the world as a human being that I would become some sort of an automaton. What I see some people doing who fortunately hit what we all pray for in addictions is a high bottom rather than a low bottom. Does that mean, those words mean anything to you? You know, we just hope that somebody catches on before the wheels totally come off, before you've lost your job, lost your house, lost your family, are really in a mess. You hope you get a high bottom where you've only been arrested for a little thing, or if not arrested, you only lost one job, but you can still get back together and make your life work. And so that's what we mean by a high bottom. But I would say of the three that I have up here, the sexual addiction and the eating disorder are the closest. And the reason they're the closest is it's important to keep both processes going and then figure out how to tease out the good parts of the process and keep them going and stop the bad parts of the process. That's not easy to do. But that's why I like to make that comparison. When we talk about eating disorders and chemical dependency and sexual addiction, we'll come at this backwards, but going by my little 5-step definition that I gave a little while ago of addiction, in all three of these, one of the things we'll see is the promise never to do it again. Now that comes out of some problem when I have overeaten, you know, eaten to the point where now I'm maybe I'm into forced vomiting, or maybe I'm whatever, you know, but I'm not going to do this again. But that happens with chemical dependency, and most of us have a fair amount of experience with this. There's so many people that deal with alcohol issues in our society that don't most of you know, either yourself or somebody else that's had problems around alcohol issues, and at one time or another says, that's it, I am done, You know, I'm not going to do that again. With the sexual issues and with the eating disorder issues, they tend to get much more closeted. You know, they're at the point maybe 10, 15 years ahead of where alcoholism is, and so they're much more secretive. We're much more shamed by them. It's a little easier, not a lot, but a little easier to say, I have an eating disorder than it is to say, I'm sexually addicted. But I don't know too many people that scream too much about that. The Tri-Delt House at the University of Washington this past year, my understanding is, was running about 65 to 70% of the young women at the Tri-Delt House were bulimic. And I only happen to know that. I mean, I don't think that only sits at the Tri-Delt House at the University of Washington, but I just happen to know that particular one because I know some people that were working with some groups. And you know, most of the gals there don't know that about each other because you don't really want to be real open about that. Interestingly enough, both with the sexual addiction issues and with the eating disorder issues, the thing that you least want to have happen is most important, and that's where you begin to, in a group, work with this and talk about it and be open about it and that sort of thing. And underlying restlessness, what happens with all the chemical dependencies, and much of this isn't new to anybody, all I'm trying to do is hammer home that it's true in the eating disorder and in the sexual addiction issue, as well as in the chemical dependency. After you get well into the addiction, what happens for you is you you get some good tolerance going. You rarely get high anymore. What you do is you sail along and then begin to dip, and the restlessness begins to hit you, and you're not feeling real comfortable, and you're in the early stages of it, and then you have to get your fix just to get back up to normal again. One of my sons, when I was wrestling with which he was dealing with alcoholism, and that particular son of mine and a couple of others, another son and a couple of other kids, we went bowling, and in the course of two frames of bowling, you know, what does that take, 40 minutes or so, that one particular son of mine drank 9 beers.
Ooh.
And you know, he absolutely was unaffected. That scared me. If I drank 9 beers in an hour, I couldn't have found which end of the bowling alley I was at, you know? So enough tolerance had, do you see what I'm saying? So what happens is the restlessness, the dis-ease begins to come, and then you bring it back. So what often happens, invariably happens, as the tolerance develops, is that I've got to have a fix, and the fix may be in food, the fix may be in a chemical, or the fix may be in lust, quote unquote. So it's as if getting drunk on lust, I can nurture myself, I can masturbate, go to an arcade, look at a pornographic magazine, set up a contact with someone else, you know, something like that. Does not believe the deviant behavior affects relationships, particularly marriage. Yeah, it's real common. We're doing fine in all three. And of course, it's not doing fine. Lots of denial. Who do you know, when you're on the outskirts of it and you're hoping, whether you understand the jargon or not, you're hoping for a high bottom with the person that you care about, all you get is denial. I don't know too many people that say, you know, think I've got an eating disorder problem. Why don't we go take a look at this? There's a period of, no, I don't have that problem. But every night I hear you upstairs, and sometimes the toilet doesn't get cleaned up, and, well, you know, whatever. Behavior is out of control. It's unmanageable. And, of course, the denial fits into there. But the behavior in all three, can you see, it just gets out of control. I cannot stop it. So I talked to a physician who is in anguish, fits all five of the criteria, but when he gets physically fatigued and he has to work four 12-hour shifts, finds himself so stressed at work as a physician that will have to slip off four or five times and go into the bathroom and masturbate to keep himself from being too anxious and then be able to keep working and that sort of thing. Frightening kind of thing for him. Might be frightening for you too, but frightening for him, or needing to get a fix alcoholically or with the food thing. Secrecy, and I talked for 2 days and we'll continue to talk about that, but the secrecy is so profound. If you don't do anything else with this kind of problem, if you're into it yourself, begin to believe that breaking secrets is the way out. Can't guarantee you if you break secrets, you're going to get rid of it, but I will guarantee you if you don't break secrets, you won't get rid of it. I'll guarantee you that. Let me say right now that I have a strong belief that who and where and how you break secrets is crucial, because I work a lot with the Christian community, and I'll find people who are so used to, skeptical of, but used to, the whole forgiveness thing in the church. A little skeptical, but still believing, you know, I can get forgiven. So you've got a quote-unquote sexual addiction issue or an eating disorder issue going on, which are much more secretive right now than alcohol. I mean, we don't like to admit it, but that's come along enough way that you can get by with saying that. Finally, break it loose and say it in front of a group or in front of some people, and I can't tell you the number of times people say, I want to go on Sunday evening at the church and tell everybody. No, don't do that. Don't do that. That's not a healthy thing. Pay some attention to the fact that coming off of any kind of toxic behavior where you have developed tolerance, and I'm talking about all three of these now, when you start coming off of it and getting rid of the toxicity, you get real crazy and your judgment will not be good at all. It isn't only chemical dependency, a little harder to see, but you start not responding to the lust drug or not responding to the eating disorder drug, you don't think good. Your boundaries get real, they get even crazier than they were. And so what I say is I make three circles. You've got a little small circle that you talk everything about. Tell how crazy you're feeling, how frightened you're feeling, and you break all your secrets. You've got a larger circle that you say to people, I'm having a difficult time, and I'm working on some issues, and there are some sexual issues that I'm working on, or some eating disorder issues, but you know, you don't get specific. And you got a larger group that you don't talk to at all. Please don't hear that as don't break secrets. What I suggest is get a 12-step sponsor, get a therapist, get a group, get somebody to help you make those decisions as to who you talk to, because your own experience will not be a very good one. People that go through, and I've worked most with the folks at Golden Valley Health Center, the author of that book, Contrary to Love, I worked a lot with Pat Carnes and those folks, and over and over and over, they say coming out of the inpatient sexual addiction program that, this isn't new to some of you, but I want to bring this point home. 6 months after you got in quote-unquote strong recovery, you look back and you say, whew, when I got out of the hospital, I was really crazy. But 6 months later now, when you're a year into recovery, you look back at that 6 month point and you say, well, I wasn't making very good decisions at all. And 2 years later, you look back at 1 year and you say, wow, I really wasn't making good decisions. I was at a conference in Minneapolis about 6 weeks ago, and now they're getting the people that have been in an inpatient sexual addiction program, which is all pretty new stuff. They've got a few hundred pieces of data of people that are now getting 3 and 4 and 5 years recovery time and really getting some good success now. People are really beginning to integrate and be very different and have some good strong recovery. See, we know this about chemical dependency. We know what it's like. We know what happens at a year. We know what happens at 3 years, you know, when you go and decide I can have a beer because you've been absolutely petrified to have a beer. So you go have a beer and nothing happens. So a month later you have 2 beers and still nothing. Well, then you're on your way. and you know, that gets real dangerous. It would be better if that first beer you had, wham, you wound up in the gutter like somebody tries to take, but you don't. So you masturbate to some pornography after a year of recovery, and it wasn't that big a deal. So that becomes insidious. We call the addict cunning and baffling, and he's out to get you. He is really out to get you. So you've got to pay attention and get in some real strong recovery. Make a couple of other statements about this. The whole issue is an intimacy issue. It's not a genital issue. I really, really, really want to stress that. It's an intimacy issue in all three of these. It's an attempt to dysfunctionally get close to love, to be loved. That may be a little harder to understand. How in the world can you, in this case, say, molest a child or whatever. And I'm mixing all these generically. But I will say that it's an intimacy issue where I don't know how to, in appropriate ways, get my intimate emotional needs met. And I may turn to any one of these to artificially do that. And short term, it sort of seems to work. I don't know about you, but I can, because I pay a lot of attention to this, I can remember having an issue of disappointment and thinking when I get home, I want to go eat. I just want to eat. I just want to nurture myself with food. And then I have to decide, am I going to do that? Or am I going to rationalize? Or am I going to not do it? You know, and that's not an issue for me big time. But it's an issue with all three of these. Mood swings, you know, the up and downer kind of thing, true and all. You'll notice the way I've written this out. Using substances or experiences to deal with feelings, particularly pain, provides nurturance. Experiences as well. That I can look for the high of an experience and so desperately want that that I'll turn to that, even though I've got my five criteria that I started with in the way. You know, it's got some cost to it. I don't feel real good about it. It's got some shame involved, but I do it anyway. And there is some tolerance, and there's some withdrawal. Lots of folks don't pay attention to withdrawal. Oh, sure, we pay attention to withdrawal in chemical dependency because we know what that's all about. And most of us have seen movies about what happens with drug addiction, and we know what withdrawal is all about. I don't know if you know this. Some of you probably could write this book better than I can. But I'll say that heroin withdrawal doesn't even hold a candle to withdrawal from nicotine. You know, heroin withdrawal, 2-3 days. Third time and you're over it. Have any of you ever tried to quit smoking? I mean, that is a killer. It used to be, I would say, that the most powerful substance we put in ourselves was nicotine, and probably next would be maybe cocaine and down the line. But I think crack is probably leapfrog, so because it's a more powerful form of drug. But the withdrawal from nicotine is really, really powerful. People that smoke a lot, the withdrawal from caffeine is powerful. You know, what lots of us don't understand is that if you're going to go into a recovery program, boy, go in. Don't try to lose weight, quit smoking, quit biting your fingernails, and drop alcohol all at once. I mean, that's crazy, because they're all so difficult to do. You've got to take care of yourself. Get a lot of sleep. Have some good people to talk to. Care about yourself a whole lot, because it's very, very difficult to break any of these addictions. Okay. Man, I don't think I'm going to talk anymore about food, but if you want to later, we can do that. I'm just looking at my time.
Over a hot bed Sunday.
Yeah.
Over a hot bed Sunday. I'd like to do this little test, and I'm really not even going to take it up, but I am going to do this. I'm going to ask you, I'm going to run through these for a minute. I'm going to hand out some of these little pieces of paper, and I would like you to borrow pencils, do whatever. I just want to take them up at the end. But I would like you to, before I get to how you score this thing, mark how many yeses and how many noes. Just make a yes-no column. And no names, anything like that, but I'd like to take those up. But this is a little sexual addiction screening test. Some of the questions seem very, very relevant. Some of them you probably wonder about. What this test is all about, and I'm going to show you how you score it in just a minute. But this test is compared to, I've got one pen. I tried to find a bunch of pencils, and there must be a bunch of pencils in this village, but I don't know where they are. They're what?
Crayons.
Well, maybe you can just borrow some. And what I'd like to do is mark your little numbers. Don't show anybody else. Don't try to look at anybody else's. Fold it over one time and let me have it if you would do that. I mean, just let me have it. Almost sounded. Just hand them to me. Were you sexually abused as a child or adolescent? And one of those things that gets tricky is lots of us don't know that we were sexually abused and were. That's an interesting, so I want to editorialize on that one for just a minute.
What do you know?
A bunch of pencils. Good. For instance, in my own case, until I'd worked in this area 2 or 3 years, I didn't realize I'd been sexually abused as a child. I didn't know that. When I was a first grader, a fourth grader named Rose took me under the front porch, pulled my pants down, did a sexual number with me. I was so dumb, my mother was standing up on the porch above me, yelling for me, and I was dumb enough to answer her. I was right down under the porch. But see, she was older than I was. She got me into doing some things which I got in trouble for, and had some sexual kinds of things that were really, I realized later, have had some real impact on me. But if you would have asked me, was I sexually abused as a child? No, I wasn't. I really believe I was, and I had a couple of other instances like that. Although they get tricky because in our society, we don't tend to think of them. I was a third grader, and a young woman named Kathleen, who was a sixth grader, did a similar kind of thing. We were all in the garage, and she had two of us that were 3 grades younger than her and pulled down our pants and masturbated us. And number one, I thought it was fun. Number two, I thought it was cool to be like the big guys. And number three, I was incredibly confused. You know, but until recently, I would have not ever said that that was sexual abuse. So I have to answer yes to that, because I was. Yes?
If you stop somebody, does that still count?
It counts for me, because there's some kind of energy going on around that. Anyway, just run through those. Have you subscribed or purchased sexually explicit magazines? Did your parents have trouble with sexual behavior? What does that mean? Well, just, I can't answer it. Yes or no? Something inside of you said yes, they did. Something inside of you says no, they didn't. I put a no on that. I don't know if they did or not, but I put a no on it. I'm just, do you often find yourself preoccupied with sexual thoughts? You know, what is preoccupied? You've got to make that decision. Do you feel that your sexual behavior is not normal? And again, you have to make the decision as to what normal and not normal is. But is there something inside of you that says, yeah, some of the stuff I do is not normal by your definition? Does your spouse or significant others ever worry or complain about your sexual behavior? Do you have trouble stopping your behavior when you know it's inappropriate? By your definition. I'm not talking about what the world says out there. I'm talking about what you live with. Do you ever feel bad about your sexual behavior? Has your sexual behavior ever created problems for you or your family? Too much, too little, trouble, whatever. Have you ever sought help for sexual behavior you did not like? Have you ever worried about people finding out about your sexual activities? Has anyone been hurt emotionally because of your sexual behavior? Are any of your sexual activities against the law? Have you made promises to yourself to quit some aspect of your sexual behavior? Now, some of the things you might not even know they're against the law, and you may have engaged in them. I talked the other day about frottage, which lots of people don't even know what that is, but basically it's just touching, some rubbing against someone in a crowded place, and then using that as a fantasy or whatever. I've talked to a number of males who have talked about enjoying being in a crowded place and making sure that they brushed against women's breasts. You know, that's against the law. You may not know that's against the law, but it is. That's not an easy one to ever arrest anybody for, but it's that kind of thing that you may not even have known that. Have you made promises to yourself to quit some aspect of your sexual behavior? Have you made efforts to quit a type of sexual activity and failed? And you can see the definition that I have has come out of all these questions. Do you have to hide some of your sexual behavior from others? And of course, it's easy to get in the rationalization and say, well, of course, I don't want a partner to know about that part, but that's normal because of what? Have you attempted to stop some parts? Have you ever felt degraded by your sexual behavior? And has sex been a way for you to escape your problem? Okay, there's a couple more questions on here. I'd just like you to run through it and have done some yeses or no's.
Wait.
Oh, did I go too quick?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Gosh.
Can you pull it up a little?
Can I switch?
No, not yet. You can't
do
yes, no questions.
What?
You can't do yes, no questions.
Yeah. Best I can say is 51-49. Yes, no. Okay, I'm gonna switch it. A few more questions. Takes us up to 25. When you have sex, do you feel depressed afterwards? Have you felt the need to discontinue a certain form of sexual activity? Has your sexual activity interfered with your family life? Have you been sexual with minors? Now, that's not fair when you were 17 and you were sexual with somebody who was 17. That's not what I'm asking you. Do you feel controlled by your sexual desire? I don't mean every minute of every day, but can you identify a period of time where, and go back to the thing that I was using all three, where you wanted alcohol real bad, or you wanted to eat real bad, or you felt controlled by the sexual desire and just couldn't stop yourself? And then do you ever think your sexual desire is stronger than you are? 24, do you feel controlled by your sexual desire? Okay, I would like to ask you to look at that. I want to show you how we score that. And then I would appreciate if you would just fold that over and let me have that, because I like to collect these things just to see what the group does. Compare that with different groups. Here's how this is scored. So all you need is your total of yeses and your total of no's. Really not real scientific. What they did at Golden Valley Health Center, which is an inpatient sexual addiction program, there's many more than 25 questions, but there's a whole criteria of determining that someone is quote-unquote addicted and someone is not addicted. All right? I'm not going into all that. I don't want to take time to do that today. But what they found was when they took the inpatient population at the hospital of people who were addicted and people who were not addicted, and so were not kept at the hospital, then they came up with these kinds of figures, that if you got four answers right, right meaning yes, if that's right, you know, four yeses, it meant that 92.1% of the people that answered four are not addicted, and 7.9% were addicted. Now, this is not a linear numerical kind of thing, because you'll notice 0 to 4, 5 to 8, 9 to 12, anything over 13, it jumps geometrically, actually, is what happens. Anybody that scores over 13, 14, 15, 17, 19, 23, 25, and I've had people score, I've had lots of people score 25 yeses just right straight down the line. Anything in the 14, 15, 16 range, 96.5% of the people tend to have some sexual addiction issues, which is kind of interesting, isn't it? And of course, I don't know. Yes.
Why does it go down when you got 25 answers correct?
I don't know. So, all I wanted to do was say that compared to an inpatient population, the way an inpatient population answers these questions, who have been adjudged addicted, several hundred people, that's something for you to look at in your own way of being. And that's not saying to me that you're addicted, or if you are addicted, it doesn't say to me that you act on it. You know, I am addicted to cigarettes, and I haven't had a cigarette since 1959, January 5th, I'll tell you folks. And I was doing two packs a day right till then. I've not had a cigarette since then, but I'm addicted to cigarettes. And I've got a program that I work real strong. I didn't like cigarettes, and I don't do cigarettes, but I'm addicted to cigarettes. So, because you have an addictive process doesn't say to me that you do it. It says to me it's a process that it would be good for you to pay some attention to. So I would appreciate, before we go, if you fold that thing over, let me have those little sheets of paper. And I want to just sort of pass those around, and you're going to throw me my pen back, aren't you?
No, I'm going to sell it to you.
Thank you. Thanks. I'm going to purposely jump to something else, and then we can come back to that little thing, because that way people don't get quite as moved. One step removed makes it a little easier to not necessarily talk just about that little test. In the in Karn's way of looking at how he works with this addiction concept, I just want to hit this lightly. Pat says that in his book, Out of the Shadows, this particular list is the thing that he wishes, it's the only thing in the book that he wrote that he wishes he hadn't done, and when he wrote the other book, Contrary to Love, he didn't do that, because this gets continually misunderstood. Now, when I talk just a little bit about this, I want to make sure that I stress the idea that all of these are whatever position, 6.8% of people who have sexual addiction in our society or whatever it is, that's as equal in the church as it is in the whole society. There is no difference. There just isn't. It may be worse in the church in one way. I don't mean worse numerically, but it may be worse for the person in the church, because as a person in the church, what may happen for me is I'm a spirit-filled, born-again Christian, and I believe in all the constructs of what's going to happen for me when I break secrets, when I get out of this ugliness, when I come into the light and get out of the darkness, and it doesn't work. And I carry my addiction with me. So now what happens for me as a pastor, as a youth worker, as a Christian businessman, as a whatever, what's wrong? Am I not a right kind of Christian? How come I still want to do this stuff? You know, it gets real, real confusing. And I'm not sure I have the answer. I'm going to give a quick one, which we're at Holden Village, where we got a whole bunch of theologians who I know understand this stuff a whole lot better than I do. So I'll give you one of my answers. And that is that, at least in a little book that I read called Haley's Bible Commentary, it said, a miracle is a breaking of the laws of nature. So nature has a way of working, an interrelatedness that works, and it works a certain way. So if I take this and I throw it up in the air, the only way it wouldn't come down is that it would be a breaking of the laws of nature, and it would stay right up there. Now, I believe that happens sometimes. I believe the Red Sea parted, and I'm kind of a literalist, and I don't have any problem with that. You know, I really do. But that's not what I see happening too much around addictions. I really believe, I've talked to David Wilkerson, it doesn't matter to you, he's the guy that wrote The Cross and the Switchblade, and I really believe that there have been people who have miraculously come off of cocaine that day and never done it again. But I don't see that happening in lots and lots of numbers. It does happen sometimes. And I don't know why. I have some other friends who, a number of years ago, most of you probably aren't even old enough to remember that, when the Philippine faith healers were kind of an item, and some friends of mine went over and took a bunch of movies, and this friend of mine, Dave, said that he stood right there and he says, I don't know, maybe I got fooled. I watched this guy, Dave was telling me, and he's got movies of this, and the movies can be sleight of hand, but he said, I was that close. I watched this guy reach a hand into a person's side, pull out a tumor, shake the blood off. He said, I got the blood on my leg, throw it on the ground, praise Jesus, and the person walked away with the tumor gone. He said he also watched the guy try it with somebody else and his hand wouldn't go in. And those guys, the Philippine faith healers, they said, we don't know why. It works sometimes and it doesn't work sometimes. God's miraculous, you know? Well, I don't understand all that. I just know that there are people that I work with who are deeply committed, spiritual people, but their addiction goes with them. And I don't know what that's all about. I know there's some things we can do about addiction, whether it's sexual or otherwise, so we work with that. And I just have to say right there that whatever reason, God didn't choose to go zap. And so maybe we have to do the miracle in a slower kind of way and help them work out. And Saturday we're going to talk about how we work out, some of the treatment kind of, what you can do. Because I do believe there's real hope there. It's hard work. It's not easy work. At any rate, the thing that Carnes didn't like about this, and I just want to go back to that a minute, is that it's almost natural, because that's the way most of us think when we get into our left brain stuff. I talk about it being like, you look at it like a typewriter, and so you go from masturbation to prostitution to pornography to heterosexual, and it's like you go across the typewriter, and then, boom, when you're done with those, you start with exhibitionism and voyeurism and indecent, boom, and you get through those. But it doesn't work that way. It absolutely does not work that way. It doesn't work that, even though I said that pastors and business people and Christians and non-Christians and intelligent and stupid and all like that have all of these issues, but they run horizontally. They don't run in a linear kind of way. The issue is, you may have more than one of those issues going on in your life in terms of an addiction, but you have it from not so problematical to more problematical, but each one of them is a separate kind of thing. So what may happen is you may have heterosexual relationships that are out of control, meaning you engage in, and then go back to my definition, you know, it's got some cost to it, it takes more and more, you feel shamed by it. Are you with me? And you may do a little of that, and then do more of that, and more of that, and more of that, and more of that, until you are consumed with that as a problem. But it runs horizontally. It doesn't move from there to molesting children. It doesn't move from there to exposing yourself. Now, you may have more than one issue, You may have an issue with masturbation, you may have an issue with pornography, and you may have an issue with indecent telephone calls. Who was the fellow in Washington, D.C., the president of the college, that hit all those issues? Some of you are not know what I'm talking about. They hit all of those issues. But each one of those issues is a separately defined one that goes from not so problematical in your life to extremely problematical in your life. The one that I think gets the heaviest anxiety and gets worked with so much is masturbation. And for what it's worth, if anybody cares about my sense of that, is that I don't personally think there's anything wrong with masturbation. But for some people, it's deadly. I personally, and I am not trying to be a role model here for the world, I don't think there's anything wrong with me with drinking. I like light beer. I like Bud Light. And I periodically drink a Bud Light beer. I don't like the regular stuff. I guess I'm kind of a wimp, but I like the light. I don't have a problem with alcohol. And so there are people who, if they do not have a problem with alcohol and don't fit any of the criteria, I don't think it's any big deal. Now, there are people, trying to make a comparison here, if, and tomorrow I'm going to talk more about the cycle issues, but if part of your cycle that gets you into some problematical behaviors is masturbation, then you can't do it. If drinking gets you into a cycle that plays into your addiction, you can't do it. You can't drink at all. If eating excessively gets you into, you can't eat excessively. Are you with me? That's the kind of way that we have to work with that. At any rate, the main thing I wanted to say was that we've got all these different levels, and anybody that's dealing with one of these issues, and particularly someone in a power position in a church who's dealing with one of those issues, that issue can just absolutely destroy your life internally. Destroy your life internally. Someone here asked me yesterday something about, or the other day, when they come to you as a friend, as a therapist, and are saying, I don't want to do this, I hate the fact that I do it, whatever, whatever, or is that pain real? It's real. You know, those of us that are caught in any of these patterns, or those of us that know people who are caught in any of these patterns, it kills you inside. You hate that. But killing you inside does not stop it. Are you with me? It won't stop. I don't care how bad you feel. All it does is slow it down for a while. So I'm going to shut up about that. That's really all I want to say about that right now. So why don't I let you have at me for a minute, because suddenly time flitted away. Throw some questions.
Why is prostitution level one?
Are you meaning that it's a crime, and so and there is a victim, so it ought to be at the second level?
Second or third?
Second or third. I think that's just an arbitrary decision that Carnes made. I mean, as I said, Carnes wishes he didn't even have the list in the book. Yes?
I don't even quite understand the different levels, the distinction between them even. Why are there levels?
Why are there levels?
Or what are the difference between level one and two, the characteristics?
Well, for one thing, except for the thing that Bob just mentioned, basically, this level does not break the law. This level always breaks the law. And in this level, there tends to be, even though it breaks the law quite often, when you're working with the folks from a treatment standpoint, of exhibitionism and voyeurism and, you know, a lot of that, there is no law. At least when people come to me for treatment, most of level one and level two are voluntary. You know, they don't. The pastor who says, I go out of town and I keep going to the peep shows and I hate it, and I want to know how to stop it. He hasn't broken any laws, but internally he's going crazy, you know. Or another pastor that I can think of, I'm not trying to pick on pastors, but we're here to talk about that today, who every time his wife would be out of town, he'd buy X-rated movies, and, you know, and he's not breaking any laws, but that's really all. Whereas at the bottom list, it's there are clearly laws being broken, and there are some differences in treatment with levels 1 and 2 and levels 3.
It looks like level 2 is kind of a detached victimization, whereas level 3 is an intimate one-on-one victimization.
And there usually is a victim at level 2, although, you know, if you've been exposed to, you're a victim. It's not like you're a rape victim, but you're still victimized. And you have all those kinds of feelings of what's all that. Yes, sir?
Is there any differences in terms of the ideology as far as what's causing these different levels of disorders?
Just tons of study going on about that. And, you know, yes and no. Sometimes it's an anxiety disorder, and maybe then it's a chemical imbalance and you want to look at some medication to help. You get into a sexually dysfunctional way to handle your anxiety, and so you get real compulsive about it. Where did that come from? Maybe that came from a dysfunctional family situation. Maybe you were abused. Although, see, we don't know the statistics, but there are many of us that were abused as children who didn't turn to these. You know, we don't know that number, so we can't. It's real hard to say specifically this is what caused it. When you're dealing with addictions, John and I were talking about this the other day. My sense of it is when you're doing regular counseling, whatever regular counseling is, I kind of look at it like a funnel like this. You develop relationship and get real close and you care and you work down. And at some point after you develop relationship, what you do is you're willing to, because you and the therapist are emotionally present, kind of open your ego up, and they become in a way part of your ego, and you are willing to shift some of your behavior. Okay, well, addiction kind of stuff is just the opposite. The funnel goes just the other way. You got to change the behavior right now, and then later on you develop the relationship. It's just the opposite switch. That's why with chemical dependency we do some more educational stuff. We have to do the group stuff and the interpersonal stuff.